Chapter 11. Chief, my mother and dad gave me this sword. Sunday afternoon, Pearl Harbor was sure of only one thing. Wherever the Japanese were, they would be back. The Pennsylvania, still squatting in dry dock number one, trained her big 14-inch guns down the channel mouth. Fireman H. E. Emery of the California teamed up with an officer who had found an old Lewis machine gun. They made a swivel mount from the wheel of an overturned cart and established themselves on a mooring quay. On Ford Island, Seaman James Lehman joined a working party filling and loading sandbags. He skinned his knuckles on the burlap, got blisters, shoveling the sand, but the situation was desperate, and he worked until it was too dark to see. At the Navy Yard, a Coxey's army of servicemen, civilian yard workers, and 100% amateurs struggled to get the undamaged ships in condition to fight. An officer of the Pennsylvania asked civilian yard worker Harry Danner to help find extra men to load ammunition. There were a number of yard hands around, but even on December 7th, a vestige of protocol remained. The officer didn't feel he could give orders to a civilian. So the two men went around together, Danner serving as ambassador. They soon had enough volunteers, and a human chain was formed between three loaded whaleboats and the Pennsylvania's ammunition hoist. They transferred over 1,000 bags of powder. Danner next headed for the Honolulu to help her get her engines reassembled. He had banged up a foot and thrown away his shoes, but he hobbled across the Navy Yard as fast as he could with another worker. They might as well have been the Japanese invasion force. Trigger-happy sentries were now stopping anybody not in uniform, and it took a lot of persuading to get through. But the work was finished by 10:30 that night. At the next pier, other yard workers struggled to install the San Francisco's anti-aircraft batteries. James Spaniola clambered around the guns, still sporting the golf shoes he wore when the attack began. It was a job that normally took 2 weeks, but this time it was done in 1 day. Through all the pounding and hammering and the clatter of pneumatic drills, a jukebox blared away at the pier canteen. Most of the time it played, "I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire." There was music on the Maryland, too. Her band tooted bravely on the quarterdeck while her gunners got ready for the next attack. The Tennessee was just as ready, but the rest of Battleship Row, once the core of the fleet's strength, was now out of the game. The Arizona sprawled, twisted and burning, a small boat alongside her fantail. Lieutenant K.S. Masterson climbed aboard and hauled down the torn, oil-stained colors still flying from her stern. He felt they should be saved as a war memento. Quartermaster Edward Vecera replaced the West Virginia's battle colors with a fresh flag borrowed from another ship. He asked an officer what to do with the dirty, ragged bunting just hauled down. The officer replied that normally all battle colors were sent to Annapolis, where they would be displayed in a glass case, but this time, well, maybe it would be better to burn them. Vecera carried out the suggestion. On the West Virginia's quarterdeck, a devoted band of officers still fought the fires that raged throughout the ship. Lieutenant Commander Doyer Johnson looked at the melted porthole glass and thought of the limp watches painted by Salvador Dali. Against fire that hot, nothing could be done. The group was finally forced off about 5 o'clock. But men still lived in the West Virginia. Far below deck, three sailors sat, hopelessly trapped in the pump room. They clung to life until the day before Christmas Eve. It was a different story on the upturned Oklahoma. Little knots of men swarmed over her bottom, tracing the steady tapping that came from within, pounding back signals of encouragement, calling for more cutting equipment. Teams from the Maryland, the salvage ship Wigeon, the Rigel, the Solace, the Navy Yard, the Oklahoma herself, worked at half a dozen different places along the huge hull. The job wasn't just a matter of cutting a hole and pulling somebody out. The tapping echoed and reverberated through the hollow space along the keel until nobody could say where it really came from. The cutters had to make an educated guess and, once inside the hull, search out the source. They had to stumble back and forth through a dark, eerie, upside-down world, tapping and listening for answering taps until they could pinpoint the right spot, then more cutting to get finally through to the trapped men. There were bitter disappointments. The first two men located were asphyxiated because the acetylene torch ate up all the oxygen. A call went out for pneumatic cutting equipment, slower but perhaps less dangerous. Julio De Castro, a Navy Yard foreman and expert chipper, took out a crew of 21 yard hands, went to work with drills and air hammers. But a new danger arose. This slower cutting method let the trapped air escape faster than the hole could be made. As the air hissed out, the water would rise, threatening to drown the men before they could be freed. The cutters used rags, handkerchiefs, anything to keep the air from escaping too fast. They weren't always successful. The teams lost all track of time. At one point, the Maryland sent over some stew, and Fireman John Gobidas of the Rigel paused long enough to grab a bite. There were no spoons or plates. He just dipped his hands, foul with oil and muck, into the stew and spread it on some bread. He thought it tasted very good. Inside the Oklahoma, the trapped men waited. 8 seamen buried in the steering engine room set up a curious democracy. Every move or decision affecting their lives was decided by vote. Their first step was to pool their clothing and their mattresses, the room was where they always slept, and plug an air vent that spouted a steady stream of water. Next, they investigated possible routes of escape, but water gushed through every door they tried, so they voted to sit back and wait. They found some tools and banged the sides of the ship, but most of the time they just sat. They had plenty of chance to meditate, and 17-year-old Seaman Willard Beale thought of all the mean things he had ever done to anyone. Just forward, in the passageway off the handling room of No. 4 turret, 30 other men were also waiting. They sat in their shorts, covered with oil, with one flashlight among them. The only hope seemed to lie in an escape hatch that led to the top deck, which now, of course, was straight down. Conceivably, a man might hold his breath, pull himself 30 feet down the hatch, cross the deck, and come up into the harbor outside the ship, but it was a very long shot. Several tried and came back, unable to do it. One succeeded, a non-swimmer, non-athlete from Brooklyn named Weissman. He told the rescue crews where to look, and a cutting team was organized. The men in the handling room passageway had no way of knowing this. They only knew that the air was growing worse and the water was slowly rising as the air was used up. By late afternoon, there were just 10 men left, and Seaman Stephen Young bet money they would suffocate before they drowned. His friend Seaman Wilbur T. Hinsberger took up the bet. They had by now lost all hope of ever getting out. Still, no one cracked. Instead, they opened a door into the lucky bag, the ship's lost and found locker, got out pea coats and mattresses, and lay down to await the end. More hours passed. Then, suddenly, incredibly, they heard distant banging and hammering echo down from above. At first it would come and go. Then it drew closer. Young picked up a dog wrench and pounded back SOS. The banging grew steadier until finally it was right outside. A voice yelled through the bulkhead, asking the men if they could stand a hole being drilled. Everyone shouted back yes, but it was a close thing. The air rushed out, the water surged up, and as the plate was twisted off, the men scrambled out just in time. Grinning Navy and civilian workers boosted them up through the ship's bottom, and they emerged into the cool, fresh air to find it was Monday. Rescuers rushed up with oranges and cigarettes, and a few minutes later Commander Jesse Kenworthy, the Oklahoma's executive officer, came by to see if they were all right. He had been on the ship's bottom directing rescue work ever since the attack. He would still be there at 5:30 Monday afternoon when Willard Beale emerged from the steering engine room. In fact, he wouldn't leave until the last of 32 survivors was pulled from the Oklahoma's hull, some 36 hours after she rolled over into the Pearl Harbor mud. But all this lay in the future. That Sunday afternoon, the survivors were just starting to emerge. 3 men were hauled out of a cofferdam, one of them clutching a basketball. He clung to it fiercely, wouldn't give it up even after reaching the Maryland's sick bay. Speculation ran wild. Some said he had saved it as a reserve supply of oxygen. Others that he planned to use it as a life buoy. Others that he was just a typical basketball player. Ensign Charles Mandel heard that while waiting for rescue, he had even shot a few baskets through a hole in the cofferdam beam. Men were also trapped on the listing California. About 3 o'clock, a rescue party cut into a compartment that was flooded with oil, hauled out 2 hospital corpsmen. They slumped on deck, looking like 2 bundles of sodden, oil-soaked rags. Pharmacist's mate William Lynch walked by, calling the names of men still missing from his unit. One of the bundles suddenly popped up, crying, "That's me!" Other crew members waged a losing fight to keep the California afloat. The tender Swan drew alongside, contributed some pumps, and radioman Charles Michaels helped drag up mattresses in a futile effort to plug some of the leaks. It was hopeless. A diver from the salvage ship Widgeon reported a hole as big as a house. Someone asked him if a collision mat would help, and he gloomily replied, "I don't believe they make them that big." Later, more salvage experts turned up from the Vestal, but even their skill was not enough. Finally, it was decided that the ship couldn't stay afloat, but could be kept in an upright position with planned flooding. Gently, the California settled to the bottom of the harbor.